Alex, let's get started with this situation in Bangladesh. How, in your opinion, what's going on there and who's interested in the situation there?
Well, I think we can narrow it down to the usual suspects. But before getting into the Bangladesh itself, I wanted to set it up a little bit because I think that the most important thing to understand is the broad context of all these crises. Because otherwise, it seems like, oh, Venezuela, oh, Syria, Libya, this. So I think that the historical broad context is very, very important here. And I have to go back to Halford Mackinder, again, because this is where the British geopolitics got their explicit formulation. And it was in 1904 that Halford Mackinder published his very important thesis called The Geographical Pivot of History. And in The Geographical Pivot of History, Mackinder kind of lays the foundation of the British geopolitics. And it's not that it hasn't been practiced in that way before. It's just that he gave it like a formulation that we can read and that we could trace through history. And so basically, his thesis was that, Britain was the great maritime empire controlling much of the world at that time. But his thesis was that it was a mistake to just be based on the oceans, and that the ultimate power in the world will be a land power. And he identified this global pivot area where the land power might emerge. And this is what he called the pivot area. It's the land that encompasses the Caucasus regions, Iran, Russia, Kazakhstan, and Afghanistan, like that part of Central Asia. And so the worry for the British Empire at the time is that he said, I'll read you the exact paragraph to so I get the quote right. So Mackinder, 1904. The spaces within Russian Empire and Mongolia are so vast, and their potentialities in population, wheat, cotton, fuel, and metals so incalculably great that it's inevitable that a vast economic world, more or less apart, will develop inaccessible to oceanic commerce. And so what was bothering the people around the British Empire at the time. So this was written in 1904. 1904 was also the year when the Russians completed the Trans-Siberian Railway. So it was seen as inevitable that a great economic power would arise there. And basically Halford Mackinder was saying that if the global circumstances changed in favor of this pivot power, which he pretty much had Russia in mind, that then it was only a matter of time when a great empire would arise, and that these massive resources would then be used ultimately for fleet building, which would then, how do you call it, challenge Britain for their command of the sea and maritime trade routes. And so Mackinder also suggested a formula about how to prevent such an empire from arising. And basically what he said was, and I think that maybe I have to read it again so I get it right. So this is a very oracular language, but I'll try to explain what it says. The formula is setting into perspective some of the competing forces in international politics. France, Italy, Egypt, India, and Korea would become so many bridgeheads where the outside navies could support armies to compel the pivot allies to deploy land forces and prevent them from concentrating their whole strength on fleets. On building the fleets. So, what is he saying there? He's basically laying out the recipe. of surrounding this pivot area with all these bridgeheads, which he identifies as France, Italy, Egypt, India. So that's what leading us on to the Bangladeshi situation, and Korea. So this was written before there was Israel. So, you know, now we have Israel, we have Ukraine, we have Pakistan, which didn't used to exist back then. We have Bangladesh, which didn't used to exist back then, and so forth. But basically, the strategy has been to surround the pivot area, and he says, to use the outside fleets to supply the land armies so that these land armies can constantly impose a war on this pivot power so that it constantly drains its economic energy so that it cannot build the fleets and it can never challenge the British Empire. So this is basically what we're looking at up until today. And somebody might say like, oh, well, that was more than 100 years ago. Well, Halford Mackinder kind of reformulated his thesis only in 1919 in a paper called The Democratic Ideals and Reality, in which he renamed the pivot area as Heartland. And he kind of refined his thesis to say that in order to rule the Heartland, you have to rule Eastern Europe first. And then once you rule Eastern Europe, you can rule the Heartland. And once you rule the Heartland, you rule the whole world island, by which he meant the Eurasian landmass. And then if you rule the Eurasian landmass, then you rule the world. And then in 1943, while World War II was in full power and the Soviet Union was destroying the Nazi forces in Russia, Halford Mackinder reasserted his thesis, saying it's still valid. It's still about the heartland. Never mind Hitler, never mind the Nazis. It's about the heartland. And, you know, there's no secret about what it's about. It's about resources and it's about making sure you control those resources. Okay, so then fast forward to today. We just had a regime change, a successful regime change, a color revolution kind of in Bangladesh, where a pro-Indian government was toppled and replaced by a pro-American one. Well, you know, a few effects of this. First, it's a loud and clear message to the Indians that the Americans are not their allies. They are, you know, they are a transactional force. They do what they do as long as it suits them. And as Henry Kissinger said, who, by the way, was also a disciple of Halford Mackinder, to be an adversary of the United States is very dangerous. To be an ally is deadly. And so this was a big slap in the face to the Modi government in India, and it puts it in a very awkward position because now it has a kind of similar proxy forces on both sides, on the east and the west, Bangladesh in the east, Pakistan in the west, with even potentially a possibility of Pakistan and Bangladesh forming some kind of an anti-Indian alliance. We're not there yet, but I think that the Americans have been trying very hard to pry India away from Russia, to coerce India to impose these draconian sanctions against Russia. And the Modi government has been resisting this pressure because it doesn't suit them. And they have very decades-long standing good relations with Russia. This is practically part of Indian national folklore. So this wasn't working. And so now it seems to me that the whole Bangladeshi regime change is perhaps to coerce India to become one of these bridgeheads that Mackinder was talking about. And he was talking about India, right? And so it seems to me an effort for the Western Empire to try to put India in its place, to coerce it to become its own proxy force, or to make their life miserable and until they toe the line, and to be to have means to destabilize India. But that's not all, because there's another point where Bangladesh could be very useful to the Western Empire, to the United States, and that is to exert pressure on Myanmar military government. Myanmar has been, okay, so China has been identified explicitly by the U.S. national security establishment as their number one adversary in the world. So Russia is second league. China is it. One of the ways that the Western powers have been trying to put a squeeze on China is by controlling the Malacca Straits, because this is where Chinese maritime commerce flows through, and it's a very it's a very narrow point, and it's relatively easy to disrupt maritime commerce there. So it's a very, very vulnerable spot for the Chinese, which is why the Chinese have been cultivating the government of Myanmar, and they have built a natural gas and oil pipeline through Myanmar to Western China, and highways for transport of goods, so that they have a second exit towards the Western oceans and the Middle East, West Africa, and Europe, so that their trade cannot be disrupted by a hostile force. And so a regime change in Bangladesh, and you know, Western powers have been trying to destabilize the Myanmar government forever. They've regime changed it successfully, but then, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi lost her power again. But they keep trying, and they're using these proxy forces. They're using terror networks. They've even taken over important trade points. They're taking control within Myanmar, and I guess that with control over Bangladesh, they can create like a second Kosovo. You know, as a Kosovo is a point of destabilization of the Balkans, and particularly Serbia, in the same way, I think that maybe Bangladesh can be used as a bridgehead against both India and Myanmar, always with the view of preventing the rise of the what Mackinder called the world empire, and destabilizing China and destabilizing in turn Russia.
Yeah, it seems that the main goal still, in my opinion, is Russia, because right now they have a direct conflict with Russia. How do you see, do you think that they're so desperate in convincing India not to have a good relationship with Russia, that's why they're trying to do these political moves in that region to destabilize the situation in order to show them that they're not in charge, they can be manipulated this the way that they're doing this right now?
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, these bridgeheads are kind of Swiss Army knives of global geopolitics, and one of the immediate objectives of pressuring India is to cause them to break their relations with Russia and to impose sanctions on Russia, which would probably have the effect of, you know, India has been the main importer of Russian oil and gas, particularly oil, and a lot of crude oil and oil products that have flown from Russia to the Western nations, especially European nations, has been coming through India as Indian, you know, blends, and through UAE. Well, you know, if they could coerce India to stop that traffic, then their energy sanctions against Russia might actually become more effective. So that's definitely part of the whole equation. But I think it's it's bigger than that still, you know, because then Bangladesh can be used to coerce India. Bangladesh can also be used to destabilize Myanmar, and so on and so forth. But, you know, I don't know. Honestly, it seems to me relatively desperate. Bangladesh is a nation of 170 million people. It's bordering India. It's bordering Myanmar. This is their trade partners. It's a poor nation. They are an important part of the China's Belt and Road Initiative. You know, so there's a future with the Belt and Road Initiative for Bangladesh. And you know, the effecting a regime change gives you a junta running the country, but it doesn't mean that it will be able to successfully execute all of these plans and the agenda that you have in mind. You know, they've been trying very hard in the same way with Georgia, and finally, you know, Georgia ended up with an independent government that is now friendly with Russia and friendly with China. And I think that the second unintended outcome of this, because they always act with a certain hubris and arrogance that they think like, we're going to do this and then we're going to manipulate all these things and make this happen. But what's going to happen is it's going to push India into the arms of Russia and China even more. And so, you know, the Russians have been trying hard to overcome the adversity between India and China. And I think that now Modi government is in such an awkward situation that they will probably have to longer term patch up their relationship with China. And, you know, in the same way that back in, you know, 2009, when you know, during Obama administration, when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, and she was saying explicitly, oh, no, there's no danger of Russia and China coming together to form an alliance. You know, like that's not even on the cards. Well, you know, that's that hubris and arrogance. And so today they're trying to coerce India. But what they're going to end up achieving, I think, is that they're going to get India to patch up their relation with China. And then they're going to have an even stronger opposition there, and a country that has now learned the hard way that there's no point trying to sit on both chairs. There's no point trying to placate the United States and the West and keep okay relationship with China and a good relationship with Russia. You have to choose your side. And I think that if you coerce them to make that choice, they're definitely going to make the choice of standing with Russia and ultimately with China as well.
And right now, I know you know Serbia very well, and what's going on with this large protest there, and what's the main reason of these protests?
Well, I know Croatia a bit better than Serbia, but okay, I'm half Serbian as well. So Rio Tinto has set its sights on Serbia for mining. There's copper there, there's gold, lithium, I don't even know, but everything they're planning to do there smacks of devastation of Serbia's natural resources, which is agricultural, arable land, and clean water. And so a significant chunk of Serbia's GDP is agriculture. And they have extensive production of fruits, which was the strongest in the former Yugoslavia. And so now the people of Serbia are rightfully concerned that if Rio Tinto goes ahead with their mining operations, that they will devastate the water resources and that they will destroy Serbia's agriculture. Now, you know, these were huge protests, absolutely huge. And I'm sitting in Croatia at the moment. And if you read the daily newspapers in Croatia, it's like a Western press. they say like, oh, there were a couple of dozen protesters. Well, if you see the aerial pictures from drones, you see that there were tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people out there. So the revolt is very, very broad based. The government obviously is going to push back against these protests. It's not going to tell Rio Tinto, okay, sorry, this is not going to work out. They're going to try to make the deal happen. They're going to try to accommodate Rio Tinto because, you know, there's always the problem of servicing your foreign debts. There's always the problem of sanctions. There's always problem of IMF loans that you depend on and so forth. And so, you know, this whole financial pressure on a government is so powerful that they will turn against their people to make this happen, to make sure that they have access to IMF loans, to World Bank loans, that there are no sanctions and so on and so forth. But again, you know, you have this example of where you're trying to strong arm a country, and this country is already kind of sitting there trying to have an okay relationship with the West, trying to become a member of the European Union, you know, which probably is not going to happen. But, you know, the EU likes to string these countries along to get them to do what they want. And then they say like, oh, yeah, you have to improve your, you know, human rights record and your judicial system and this and that. So you never actually end up joining. But it's been politically one of the constants that, you know, like a segment of the Serbian population positively wants to join the West and wants to be part of the EU. And this is now losing popularity, but it's still there. So it is some kind of a political pressure on the government. But now you have obviously a very strong turnout against this. So if the government turns against the people will turn against the government. And so then the government pays a political price. And who knows, you might end up with a different government down the road, which is going to say like, no, we're done with all this. We're not going to be a member of the EU, and we're claiming our resources back, and we're going to be joining Russia's and Chinese Belt and Road Initiative and all these multipolar integrations, and particularly at a point where Russia might wrest control of Odessa and of the of the isthmus of the Danube River into the Black Sea, then Serbia has a friendly exit to the warm water ports, and at that point they're much less susceptible to sanctions. So you know, it's a struggle right now. It's about the profits of a large mining corporations. But tomorrow it might be losing a potential ally in favor of Russia. So again, you know, they're going hard with hubris, with arrogance, and they always end up getting unintended consequences and opposite outcomes.
Yeah, you've learned that Shoigu was talking about sending weapons to Serbia and helping them. Do you think that this is there are some notions in the mind of some understanding in the mind of Russians that they're thinking that the West is manipulating the situation in Serbia? That's why they need to be more present in Serbia in order to not having any sort of problems in the future.
Yes, there's no question about the fact that Russia is providing weapons to Serbia, and so Serbians have obtained a MiG-29 aircraft from Russia, and they obtained an S-400 system, at least one, and I think that this system was transferred to Belgrade, and you know, I think it was like some kind of a military fair where it was going to be shown. But then apparently it stayed in Serbia. And then who knows, you know, there are probably secret programs that we don't know about. But for sure, the Balkans are might be a problem in the future. It might be one of these bridgeheads. And I think that the Western Empire would like nothing better than to use Serbia as a point of destabilization in the Balkans. And it does have it, you know, like Myanmar, Serbia has Kosovo, like Myanmar now has Bangladesh. And Kosovo is basically a U.S. protectorate. And they have a very, very large military base, which has been used by the U.S. as this massive training ground for jihadi militants that were then sent off to Libya and to Syria, you know, to do the dirty work for the empire. And of course, this is a very, very vulnerable point of friction for Serbia as well. Another reason why Serbia is susceptible to Russian influence, even though the Serbian government under Vučić is very unreliable. You know, it's in the sense that they are kind of like Erdogan in Turkey, that they're kind of bending however the wind blows. But I think that the more West exerts pressure on Serbia, I think the more it's going to end up pushing Serbia into the arms of Russia. And then, you know, Vučić might not be there forever, and Vučić might have to bend to the popular will of the Serbian people. And I think that in the end, there might be a political change where Serbia says, okay, no mas, we're going to work with Russia. And I think that we should watch that as soon as the situation in Ukraine is resolved. I don't expect that the Russians are going to take over Odessa militarily, but I think that it's going to be part of the capitulation deal with Ukraine, that Russia is going to take over Odessa administratively. And it's going to purge it of this Banderite neo-Nazi element. And then it's going to wrest effective control of Odessa, of the port. And it's going to wrest effective control of the whole Black Sea coast all the way down to Romania. And then Serbia has an out. And it might change the calculus very considerably.
And right now in Ukraine, we know that Ukrainians attacked the Kursk region, which is Russia, Russian soil, Russian territory. And NATO is behind the whole situation. Because without NATO, they couldn't do that. But do you think that is there anything good coming out of this for Ukrainians in order to have, for example, let's assume that they're going to have, for instance, have a better position in order to have some sort of negotiations, political settlement in the future? Or it's going to be just the opposite way, just going to make Russians more serious, more rigid toward the conflict in that region?
Okay, so the whole Kursk incursion makes next to no sense at all, because the Ukrainians went in there with very, very feeble supply lines, so very fragile logistics, and no air cover. And they went there with, I don't even know anymore, is it 1,000 troops, 3,000 troops? I think initial wave was 1,000, but then it got reinforced, and now they lost well over 1,000. So it's a bigger force than that, but still no chance of sustaining that. You know, if you're going to take over a territory, you have to be very confident that you're going to be able to defend it and hold. You're just sacrificing your soldiers. You're wasting your resources for a misadventure that you're going to have to roll back. So it's just a gratuitous loss. And why this was done, I think, was maybe given away by the German, but the German head of the Bundes defense. How do you call it? The Bundestag. German. Not the Bundestag, but Bundestag Defense Committee, and he basically said that it's going to be to improve Ukraine's negotiating position. But just to put this into perspective, sending into Russia a couple of thousand soldiers with no air cover and fragile supply lines is a pinprick. It's nothing. So in 1941, the West, you know, not really Hitler, but Hitler and a lot of other countries that contributed, they put together the largest invasion force ever. So it was 3.8 million troops, 3,350 tanks, 600,000 vehicles, 2,770 aircraft, right? 7,200 artillery pieces. It was the largest invasion force ever assembled. And they took Russia, not quite by surprise, but almost. And Russia was in a relatively weaker position than it is today, you know, because previously Stalin has done a massive purge of officer. There was a bit of a disarray. The morale was bad. And still this massive invasion force was ground down and defeated. So what's an exhausted Ukrainian army with a couple of thousand soldiers, no air cover, a lot of, you know, equipment that's difficult to maintain and repair? Where is it going to go? The day they run out of ammunition, it's over. And so I think if I add it all up, I try to think, what were they trying to achieve? Well, you've seen over the last few days a lot of talk about sending more money to Ukraine, and they have done so. Another few billion flowed to Ukraine. We've heard talk about further weapons transfers, Leopard 2 tanks from Germany and so forth. I can't work it out that the rationale is anything more than a cynical ploy to do another run of war profiteering, because somebody's going to make a lot of money on all this. And since the cow's dying, then they're eager to milk whatever they can before it's completely dead. And, you know, dead Russians, dead Ukrainians, they don't care. And it's not going to improve the negotiating position of Ukraine. If anything, it's going to make it worse. And so I think ultimately it's a war profiteering adventure. Somebody in the shadows that we don't know who it is exactly is going to profit, and they don't care what the collateral damage is.
Do you think this type of activity would bring some sort of changes in the behavior of Russians toward the conflict in Ukraine, or they're going to continue the same way, the same rational way that they have been doing this? They have been fighting Ukrainians together with NATO so far.
Well, I think that, you know, once you start killing civilian population and destroying civilian infrastructure, and this is not new, you know, the Ukrainians have been trying to do it for a long time, you know, with the attacks on Crimea, attempts to destroy Crimea Bridge, attacks on Russian commercial vessels, attacks in Belgorod and so forth. Not to mention the 8 years between 2014 and 2022, when Ukrainian forces have killed about 14,000 Russians, most of them civilians. So this is not a new thing. But what it does is, when you do this on a large scale, is it solidifies the position of the political leadership, and it gives them, I think, extra maneuvering space to go hard, to go to maybe say, well, now we're taking everything to the east of the Dnieper River, and including Kiev, and maybe through the north through Belarus, another incursion. They have all those options, and the people in Russia will support it. And so that's I think that's all that happened. But I don't know that that's necessarily a new thing. I think we've already been there. I think that this last thing, remember the Crocus terror attack? I think that was already a turning point. This just reinforces already the decisive position that Russia as a whole of society has taken with regards to this war. And not only this war, the proxy war with Ukraine, but confronting the West. And so, it's going to achieve blowback and nothing more.
The other thing would be the behavior of Germany before this war started, or in the beginning of this conflict. They were so hesitant to be part of this conflict, sending weapons, sending tanks. They were forced by other European countries, together with the United States. We remember that. But how right now, the way that they're bragging about German tanks on Russian soil, are they changing? Is this conflict changing their mind? Because none of what has happened in Ukraine is helping Germany and its future. But at the same time, you see the manner of the government, the way that they're getting more radical, the way that the publication, the famous publication in Germany, are talking about the conflict. It seems that they are on the front line in Ukraine fighting Russians.
I think that Germany is being coerced into this position. And you're very correct that at the beginning, they were very hesitant. And one thing that went almost unnoticed, that at the last moment, just before the beginning of the special military operation, Olaf Scholz tried to broker a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine, and it was shot down. But he was very anxious to not have this war. And then when it came to providing aid to Ukraine, he really did drag his feet. But I think that the political class in Germany, which is in large part the Greens, and in concert with NATO, with the media in Germany, and with the intelligence agencies, are pushing this pro-Ukrainian agenda. And they are very, very harshly repressive to people who are questioning this policy. But, as far as German people are concerned, my information is that most people in Germany actually sympathize with the Russian side. And, obviously you will not hear this from the mainstream media, but you can see it in the changes in popularity of political parties. And when there was an incident, I think in 2022, when they brought a destroyed Russian tank to Berlin to display it, that the German people brought flowers, and they put flowers on the tank to honor the Russian soldiers who died in that tank. And then, that was, those photographs went around like wildfire in the social media, but the mainstream media completely ignored it, because they're trying to pretend that everybody supports Ukraine. But that is not true at all.
The other thing would be, right now in the European Union, especially, let's focus on Germany, do you think anything left in Germany? Or even right, because it doesn't matter right now if you get Storm or you get Sunak. It doesn't matter if you get Greens or get the other way. But at the end of the day, you're going to end up with the same thing. You're going to end up with the same kind of ideology. They're going to just shift in the suits. But the mindset is the same. And these people who are willing, we know that Europeans, many people want some radical changes, some drastic changes happening in terms of their policy and the way that the European Union has been weakened. And do you see, in your region, is that possible that we're going to have some sort of changes in the way that people want to be? Or getting back to the first question, is there anything left or right left in Germany?
I think we're definitely going in that direction. And I think that the political establishment in the European countries has been preparing for this. They know which direction we're going to. And I think that probably this is why all these migrations have been organized. And we see now what's happening in England. And it's not clear to me what's really happening, but it's clear the narrative they're trying to make us believe that there's like a massive conflict between these Muslim migrants and the local British population. Whereas, you know, I listened to a podcast with Alexander Mercouris today, who said that he doesn't see any of it where he lives, and that he has contacted many of his friends around England to ask them, like, hey, what's it look where you are? And everybody says, like, no, it looks pretty normal. It's calm. But, you know, you see a lot of this footage of conflicts. You see a lot of the footage of one side and then the other side demonstrating and being aggressive and so forth. But I think that what it's doing is they are promoting a narrative that is allowing the government to get very, very repressive. And we have now a government in England that almost resembles the situation that we saw in the film V for Vendetta. I don't know if you saw that film, but it's a very dystopian sci-fi film about a totalitarian government in Britain. And, you know, some of the stuff that you see in that movie, which back then, I think it was made in 2009 or 10 or something like this. Back then, it seemed fantastic. It seemed unthinkable stuff. But now some of the narrative in that movie is really, really close to what you see Keir Starmer saying and what you see British media talking heads saying. And then also, so basically, you know, I think that maybe this is coming to Europe where they, you know, foment some riots, real or fake, and then they crack down and they try to repress any kind of a populist movement under the guise of keeping the peace and preventing bloodshed and all of these things. And, you know, there's millions of migrants in Germany, in Belgium, in France, in Ireland. And I think that the agenda very probably is to use those migrants to prevent any kind of a real political change or revolution, and to keep the populations subdued.
Just to wrap up this session, Alex, talking about shifting the gear to the conflict in Gaza, Mahmoud Abbas was in Russia. And in your opinion, right now, the way that China and Russia are seen or looking at that region and the conflict between Iran and Israel, the way that they assassinated the political leader and military leaders of Hamas, which were so moderate, and they were supposed to negotiate with, but they went after assassinating these people. And Do you understand what the United States is trying to do in the Middle East? Because it doesn't make sense what they're trying to do right now.
Well, the United States wants to maintain their hegemony in the Middle East at all costs, except that they've lost the capability to do this. And now, you know, Israel was a useful pawn in the region. Israel was created as one, you know, I used to believe, like most people, that Israel was created as a homeland for the poor persecuted Jews after World War II. But the reality is that the creation of Israel was planned by the British Empire as one of the bridgeheads to be able to destabilize the region and to make sure that the Western interests, i.e. British financial power, could defend their hegemony over this very resource-rich region. Except now, you know, I think that Israel has outlasted its usefulness. The Benjamin Netanyahu government is desperate to escalate the war and to drag the United States into it. An enlarged conflict would give them a lot more maneuvering power. If the United States got dragged into it, then, you know, sooner or later, the rest of NATO would follow, European powers would follow. Israel could then maybe in a larger war even contemplate launching a nuclear attack on Iran, because this has been a 3-decade-long obsession of Benjamin Netanyahu to destroy Iran somehow. And it seems to me that the Iranians are very, very wise to all this, and that the Russians and the Chinese are advising them well, and that they are, you know, one thing that I have observed. So what is it today? It's the 14th August. It's been more than 12 days since the Iranians announced that the retaliation for the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh was hours away. Well, they didn't say how many hours, but it's been many, many hours now, and nothing much happened. But, you know, what has happened is that the Houthis have intensified their attacks on commercial vessels and the United States naval vessels in the Red Sea. And then we've also seen that the Syrians have launched a military attack on U.S. proxies to wrest control of the northeastern regions and an oil production facility near Deir ez-Zor area. And then we've seen, you know, Hezbollah launch sustained attacks against Israel. So, and we also saw Iran's proxy militias in Iraq launch attacks on U.S. bases. So it seems to me that the retaliation might be gathering in more in shape of the attack on the United States than directly on Israel. So Hezbollah is doing sustained pinpricks against Israel, so Israel cannot really relax and think that they got away with anything. But it seems to me that the real retaliation is against the United States and their interests in the region. And what's the effect of that is that the defense of Israel is becoming very, very costly for the United States and the Western Empire. And so Israel is definitely outlasting its usefulness. And I think that the effect is going to be that there's going to be more and more political pressure to just kind of end with Israel, to end the support for Israel. And then, you know, the state might collapse like a house of cards, basically by people not wanting to live there anymore and its economy collapsing and, you know, the whole thing just kind of disinflating and disappearing without really having to launch a spectacular massive attack and you know, give Benjamin Netanyahu what he's desperate for, and that would be an escalated conflict in the region.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Alex, for being with us today.
Always a pleasure.
Pleasure. Great. Thank pleasure you. As always. See you soon. Thank you.